Okay, thank you very much. What I'd like to talk about, you can see the title there, Modern Physics for Your Classroom, the GPS and Relativity. And this really came about, one of the outreach programs we have here at Perimeter Institute is our Physica Fantastica Tour. And what that is myself and a number of our researchers going around to various schools, to grade 11 and 12 physics classes, physics students, and giving talks on particular aspects of modern physics. And the goal is to teach them more about modern physics, and also to motivate them, too. So it's not just about the facts. It's about getting them enthused and inspired. And I find it very easy to sell modern physics, because I think it's very fascinating. There are a lot of interesting things in it. It's a matter of just exposing students to and telling them about that. But one thing I particularly wanted to get across was I realized, and I'm sure we all do, that for the most students, they think of relativity and a lot of modern physics, quantum mechanics, as, well, you know, they're just these theories. They're impractical. They're just these almost like these inventions of scientists in their ivory towers. And they certainly don't think of them as impacting upon their daily lives as being relevant. You know, why should I learn about relativity? When am I ever going to use it? And so, as we all know, they're incredibly powerful, incredibly practical. And just generally, science and particular knowledge in physics, basic knowledge about the world around us, has fed through time and time again into the way engineers have designed new products and useful devices and made modern electronics, communications, and so forth. So I really wanted to get across this idea. I guess the message in three words was relativity is real. And that was the inspiration for this talk. And also, I just think that the GPS is just a very, very cool story. This thing, I mean, it really starts with Einstein, 1905, special relativity. And who would have thought 80 or something years later that the theory of Einstein was not a practical person at all, would come up with this very powerful, useful, incredibly amazing technology. So to outline, just talk a little bit about the Physica Fantastica Tour, where we went this year. The slogan, relativity is real, and the global positioning system, and maybe also talk a bit about PET scan, positron emission tomography scans, which are spatial brain scans, and look at the outcomes, how things turned out. So, as I said, the Physica Fantastica Tour we have for grade 11 and 12 physics students. We've been doing that for a number of years. And we do that once or twice a year, and we could go sort of in spurts. And the last spurt that we had over the last month was myself and one of the researchers here went to Waterloo, which it wasn't very hard to get there, Toronto, Sudbury, Manitoulin Island, Ottawa, Fort Frances, Dryden, and Rainy River. And it's about 20 schools in total. And one of the presentations, the main one I gave, was Everyday Einstein. And here's some photos. This is actually in Markville Secondary College in York, just north of Toronto. And these are some students that's at Manitoulin Island, Manitoulin Secondary School. So two of the schools that we did visit. And I guess what I'll do is talk a little bit about it and then kind of run through some of just what I teach the students with relativity and the GPS. So I talk about two applications. The global positioning system in nuclear medicine. And what I find is most of the students, so I did this about a couple of weeks ago, so most of the vast majority of the students, they hadn't actually got around to Unit 5, the matter-energy interface. So they hadn't really seen special relativity before. So first I had to skin a little gentle introduction to it, talk about Newtonian mechanics. They're all familiar with that, Newton's laws of motion. They encode a theory of motion. And in some sense, you can think of special relativity as being a different theory of motion that supersedes Newtonian mechanics. And I have some videos, actually, of what you would see if you were traveling close to the speed of light. So a roller coaster ride at 99% the speed of light. And so part of that is, you know, just to get them awake, get them interested, get them thinking and enthused about special relativity. And after that, I talk about these applications and say it's more than just what some sort of video game or something like that. So I guess the first goal is obvious, to get students to see that modern physics, it's more than just about theories. It's alive, it's real, it's useful. And the second one, I really wanted to have a presentation where they're actively involved. It's not just something that we're sitting, it's a chalk and talk, they sort of passively could sit there. So I really wanted sort of activities, calculations, and real physics that they could do. So that was my second goal. And the third one was to produce something that teachers could do themselves when I wasn't there. I mean, it's practically impossible for us. I mean, I'm there 1 hour once a year. And I can't be sort of at every school. We can't have people from Perimeter Institute at every school. And really, the most important people are yourselves, the people that will be with the students hundreds of hours throughout their lifetimes as student. And so if we can give, in sense of give an example of something that teachers could do, or might give them ideas for what they could do, that was another one of the goals that we had to model the instruction. So these are the three main goals. And so what I talked about was, again, the global positioning system, who I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with. But of us right now are 24 satellites owned by the US military. And they're 20,000 kilometers above the surface of the Earth. And they're orbiting around once every 12 hours. And continually, all the time, emitting microwave radiation. And if you have a GPS receiver, and these are commercial products, you can buy them for about $200 from Canadian Tire, from hiking stores, you pick up all the signals from the GPS satellites. Or to be more correct, you actually pick up all the signals from the GPS satellites that are above your horizon, above the horizon for where you are on the planet. And they basically figure out the orbits, their overlapping orbits, so that all the time, no matter where you are, there are always at least four satellites that are above the horizon. And that basically, for getting signals from four satellites, is the minimum amount you actually need to pinpoint wherever you are, anywhere on the surface of the globe, down to within a couple of meters. So that's the accuracy. So it's a navigation system, and it's just incredibly widely used. It's used by commercial pilots to help land their planes, especially in bad weather, taxi drivers and delivery drivers, satellite navigation for cars. You see the little computer screens with a dot on the computer screen, an electronic picture of streets and street directory. That involves GPS. Hikers use it to help make sure they keep on trails. Farmers even actually use it to help plant their crops in the right configurations. And I recently found out construction workers actually use it when trying to basically sort of dig in the right places. Commercial bulldozers drive when they're building a new shopping complex or apartment complex or something like that. So millions of people around the world use it every day. And hidden in there, a very, very crucial part of it is special relativity. So where it actually comes in, the GPS satellites, they're moving at about 4 kilometers a second. So even that's not even 1% of the speed of light. Basically, because they're moving relative to us at 4 kilometers per second, it's a non-trivial speed. Basically, that means there's a small time dilation effect. Not much, but it's actually enough that if you don't throw it, take it into account, the GPS system is so precise, it actually basically throws everything off and errors accumulate just in the distance from where you think you are. So you actually need to correct for that time dilation. So it's a practical application, commercial application of time dilation from special relativity. So how does it work? So we have one GPS satellite up there. So it's emitting the microwave radiation. And we're down here on the planet. And we have our GPS receiver. And all the signals that get sent out, they have time codes, what are called time codes on them. So they tell you exactly the time that they were sent from the satellite. So there might be a signal here, and it might have the time code, yes, this was sent at exactly 12 noon, midday, from this GPS satellite number 7. Comes down towards you, you pick that up, and basically the GPS receiver can decode the information. Yes, it was sent from GPS satellite number 7, was sent exactly 12 noon. And we know where GPS satellite number 7 was at 12 noon. We know, you know, the pre-programmed orbits. And so basically there's a clock inside the GPS receiver. And so it looks to see what the time is. And it might be 1 minute past 12, hypothetically. And so you know it took 1 minute from the signal to get from you, from the satellite to you. So that's you know, the time. The question is, so how fast did the microwave radiation travel from the satellite to you? Well, pretty much it's actually traveling just through empty space. Most of the time. And electromagnetic radiation traveling through empty space, 300,000 kilometers per second, the speed of light. So you know the speed, you know the time, you multiply those two together, and then you get the distance. And so what you find there is the distance you are away from that satellite. So think of the locus or the set of all points that are one particular distance away from, a constant distance away from a satellite or a point, then that's actually a sphere. So it's kind of hard to draw, but I've drawn a circle there, but all those points on that circle, obviously the circumference, are the same distance away from the satellite. And so what you actually get is you know you're somewhere on the surface of a sphere of a particular radius centered on the satellite. So, you know, that's some information about where you are, but obviously there are, you know, you could be anywhere. On that surface of the sphere. I guess what you do know, you're somewhere at the intersection of the surface of that sphere and the surface of the Earth, because you know you're not floating out into space. So what you actually need to do is to get signals from more satellites. So you repeat the process, a signal from another satellite. Then you know you're at the intersection of the two spheres that you have. And turns out what you actually need to do is repeat that process twice more and actually get signals from four satellites, and that's enough to pinpoint wherever you are on the surface of the planet. What I kind of fudge a bit, and I think this is legitimate with students, and I say what you need to do is you actually need to get signals from three satellites, which technically is correct, or would be correct, if the satellites have if the GPS receivers actually had atomic clocks inside them. If that's the case, you wouldn't actually need the extra fourth satellite to be something of a check. And so we're essentially just doing some sort of triangulation process. You're building these three spheres, and there's just one unique point where they all intersect. And an intuitive way I like to explain it to them is when you want to find out where you are, you want to know three coordinates. You want to know your longitude, how far you are around from Greenwich to zero longitude. You want to know your latitude, just how much you are above or below the equator. And you want to know your altitude, just what height or depth you are above or below sea level. So three coordinates, three satellites. So that's what I tell the students. So that's kind of a rough idea of what's going on, so the basic idea of how it works. So far there's no Einstein or special relativity in there yet. But then just to kind of make it real, this is actually an ad from Caterpillar, well-known industrial machinery company. And if you kind of look closely there, you can see that AccuGrade GPS grade control system. And it turns out that Caterpillar started fitting their industrial bulldozers a few years ago with GPS receivers and GPS systems. And these were bulldozers that basically were building, helping to dig the holes and the ramps and or whatever for new shopping centers and new apartment complexes. So they were going from the plans. And it turns out that it was actually very useful and more productive for them to be guided via GPS navigation than the systems actually using. There was a very significant economic benefit actually being controlled and used with the precision, the level of precision in the GPS system, actually guiding the bulldozer driver and helping him or her navigate sort of where, you know, we want to build there's going to be a basement in this shopping center, it's going to be 10 meters wide by 5 meters, it's going to be 15 meters deep or whatever. So, you know, dig here, dig this depth. GPS navigation was useful enough to be used for that. So this is one application. So then sort of gets into, I thought I should at least put some mathematics in the slide and some math and so forth for more interested students or more mathematically minded students. So it was a bit of a challenge because at this point I talked about time dilation, or sometimes I talk about it, I sort of like talking about it sometimes at least as time slowdown. Just I think it's a more sort of evocative phrase for some students, so I use them sort of interchangeably. So I talk about, you know, the time slowdown and say, well, this is the formula that encodes that. And for example, so really don't worry about it too much, but the point is if you have, if you have the GPS satellite up high in the sky 20,000 kilometers above you, it's ticking away, there's a clock on it at a certain rate, how much time ticks on that clock is in between two events happening is, say, the T naught there, and how much time we perceive or ticks for us being down here on Earth with the satellite moving relative to us at, again, this very, very high speed because it's orbiting around the Earth very quickly, is this T here. And what relates the two is the time slowdown factor, or the Lorentz factor, or the gamma factor. Normally I talked about it as the time slowdown factor. I found that just a bit more sort of useful and accessible. And I say again, sort of his, if you want the mathematical formula for the time slowdown for the Lorentz factor or the gamma factor, this is what it is. Don't worry about it too much, but that's a function of, the most important thing is the speed of light is in there, c. I have to explain that or tell them that c is the symbol for the speed of light. And then most importantly, it's v, the velocity of the object, of the satellite, or whatever the object is relative to us. The V's in there, so it's a function of V. So important thing is, you know, focus on the graph here. And if you actually plot gamma is a function of v, what you find is, and you'll know this, that it starts out at 1 when the velocity is 0, and then just rapidly increases up to become infinitely large when you actually get to when you get to see here the speed of light. But then I also sort of like to point out, just in case they don't think, well, you know, how come should I be seeing this on my bike or a fast car on a freeway or something like that, that really, even if you get in the fastest experimental jet plane we have, that would not even move it at even a tenth of 1% of the speed of light. The speed of light is very, very, very fast. And so what we live the velocities, the relative velocity we just live our entire lives at, and we're used to all our waking experience, is basically just in this little patch here, where it's just the gamma factor, the time slowdown factor, is almost identical 1 to 1. So it's just you know, we don't see it with our eyes in everyday life, obviously. So that's that factor. Then I say, okay, that's the formula. It's known the GPS satellites move at 4 kilometers per second to them. Okay, kids, get out your calculators. Get around with a group of people, a bunch of friends, 3 or 4, and calculate what is v according to that factor. And so the first couple of schools I went to, I said, okay, well, you know, they just plug v in, divide by c squared. I told them c is 300,000 kilometers per second. I had told them that before. Get the answer, and they'll find it's actually 1, and I think there's about 10 zeros, and then it's 8.89. So, that, you know, that's easy. They'll get that. But what I found is basically 95%, 99% of the students just said it's 1. And so what I realized was what they were doing is they were basically they have 4 squared divided by 300,000 squared is a very, very, very small number. So it's a tiny number. And then 1 minus that tiny number, a lot of the calculators are actually giving 1. So and so basically giving 1, and then obviously you take the square root of 1 is 1, 1 divided by 1 gives you 1. And so basically their calculator gave them that. And so they were telling me the answer was 1. And so their calculator was infallible. It was God. Their calculator said it's 1, so it has to be 1, without really even kind of sort of thinking about that. But I guess it is a fairly, I mean, it is a fairly, what I realized, what I learned from that is, It is a quite sophisticated skill to have this very, very powerful tool and to know when you can use it, when it's applicable and when it's not applicable. So I thought, well, you know, that wasn't really working. So I thought, well, there's the binomial expansion. And you can actually, when v squared divided by c squared, when it's actually a small number, you can use the formula 1 plus x all to the power n is 1 plus n x plus n minus 1 x squared plus 2 plus et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can use that approximation, but you can just truncate it at the first order term after the first order term. And so when v is very, very small by the binomial expansion, then gamma is approximately equal to 1 plus v squared divided by 2 c squared. And the 2 actually comes in because you've got the square root there, so that gives you a power of 1/2. So you've actually, that's equivalent to 1 minus v squared divided by c squared to the power minus 1/2, and the minus 1/2 actually gives you this 2 down there. So then I said, okay, the next probably 2 or 3 schools, I said, okay, come calculate what this is. But again, I actually still got 95% of students getting the answer 1. And again, they were just blindly putting in their calculator and trusting their calculator. Which I guess in some sense is reasonable because 99% of the time you calculate it, it does give you the correct answer. So it takes a bit of sophistication to know when it's applicable and when it's not, to actually step back and know, hang on, you know, this is not reasonable. So then I thought, well, you know, I talked to someone of the researchers here, and so I changed it, and I said, okay, just calculate v squared divided by 2c squared, and that's the correction factor you have to the time. That was fine. The only problem people had with that is just getting the unit. So some people, very much they were used to using 3 by 10 to the 8 meters per second for the speed of light. That was the units that they had. So they would do 4 squared divided by 2 times 3 by 10 to the 8 squared and get a wrong number out by, I guess it's out by a factor of a million. But then after a little while, you just sort of, hey, you know, did you match the units in the denominator and numerator? And then after a little while, people got the correct answer, which is this here, 8.99 by 10 to the minus 11. So it's a very, very small number, about 10 to the minus 10. And then what I said is, okay, that's the correction factor you have to the time slowdown. So if time slowdown is 1, then there's no time slowdown whatsoever. But you have this small correction factor here. And so you have, this is a tiny, tiny number. And what happens when you add a tiny, tiny number to 1? Well, you know, you get something 1 plus a little bit more. And I said, okay, that's actually what you get with the GPS satellite, with this time slowdown factor. How much we perceive, or from our perspective, the time and the GPS clock is going more slowly. And so it's, and so, okay, so that seemed to work. So I was happy with that. Now, so that translates to, so we're here down on Earth. We have the clock and the GPS receivers ticking away. And for, basically, so for what happens is for every second that we perceive the GPS satellite clock as ticking away, 1 second plus that teeny tiny bit more, 1 second plus 10 to the minus seconds ticks away on Earth because the GPS satellite appears to us to be slow. So the GPS satellite clock is exactly like a faulty clock. It's this dodgy clock that's just slightly slow and gets more and more out of sync and more out of time with the accurate clocks that we have on Earth from our reference frame and perspective. And then I tell the students, so okay, so you're off by this sort of time amount every second. But what we're dealing with the microwaves traveling at the speed of light. So if you're off every second by 10 to the minus 10 seconds, what distance error would that induce if you actually didn't correct for this factor, this difference in the times? And so then I say, look, how far does light travel in 10 to the minus 10 seconds? You know the speed of light, you've got the time, multiply those two together to get the distance. So okay, go away, calculate it, give them a minute or so, 30 seconds, that's generally easier. I found maybe 20% of students could just get it off the top of their head. A few checked their friends to gain their confidence, and then pretty much everyone got the right answer. And so the answer is, you know, 3 centimeters, 10 to the minus 2 meters. So okay, that's the distance error. So 1 second, so it's not too bad. I mean, if you're you know, a taxi driver, you're trying to get the right street address, it's not going to matter if you're off by 3 centimeters. But turns out that's actually 3 centimeters every single second. So if you have if you have two clocks and they're slightly out of sync with each other at different times, as time goes on after it, even if only a fraction out by a fraction of a second every single second, after a day, a week, a month, they'll just get more and more out of sync with each other. The time will actually get greater. Errors accumulate. That's exactly what happens in the GPS. So what you actually need to figure out, if you want to figure out the error every day, in the sense that's sort of induced by special relativity, by time dilation, or really maybe the error. So what the GPS system does, it actually basically, the software in the GPS receivers actually correct for the time slowdown, actually sort of factor that in and know that, okay, even though the signal seemed to come from 12 o'clock from the GPS satellite number 7 up in the sky, well, we know that clock is running slowly due to time dilation from our reference frame. So we actually need to know, okay, so it was actually sent a little bit later than that. So actually, basically, need to make that correction. That's what it does. But if you ignored special relativity, said, you know, theory, it's just a theory, you know, it doesn't matter, it's just some science fiction thing, it's irrelevant, then to find out there every single day, basically, how many seconds are there in a day? There are 24 hours in a day. Each second has, or each hour has 60 by 60, 3,600 seconds. So do the math, and I go, okay, kids, get your calculators out again, try it. Very simple calculation. 30 seconds, they come back with me, 2.5 kilometers, 2.6 kilometers. And that's what the answer is. And then I tried to think of what's the most dramatic example that would try and sort of make it real. And then I say, so imagine, so if you think that special relativity is just theory, then imagine you're the pilot of a Boeing 747, and you're landing it at Toronto Pearson Airport. And it's February, and it's a snowstorm, and it's full of 300 passengers. and you're trying to basically get them safely home, and you can't see the runway because of the snowstorm. And so if you're using GPS navigation to help get you home, as many pilots do, amongst other navigation systems, and you think this theory is relativity is just a theory, and you have your GPS receiver, and somehow you have a button, a magical button on it, and you say, well, let's turn relativity off because it's just Einstein, it's just, you know, modern physics and stuff, then, you know, at the very least, you're probably going to be landing not in the runway, but 2.5 kilometers away in a field or a road, and that's probably not going to be a good thing. So that's one application of special relativity, the GPS. And I also do point out because, so it's a little bit complicated. There are a lot of details I have to leave out because it turns out that general relativity actually is involved too. So the GPS clocks actually run slow by a little bit. It actually turns out to be about 11,000 nanoseconds every day due to time dilation from our reference frame. But it turns out by about four times that effect, 39,000 nanoseconds every day, they actually run a little bit fast due to general, actually, no, it's 50,000 nanoseconds every day due to general relativity. And that's because, again, I don't go into the details with the students, but just say that in general, just point out that there is this other effect. So it's kind of cool in a way. There's actually general relativity and special relativity in the global positioning system. But one thing in general relativity is that the stronger the gravitational field, the stronger the gravity, the slower time goes. So if you actually have if you have a clock and it's down the surface of the Earth near a stronger gravitational field than 20,000 kilometers up, it will actually tick more slowly due to this gravitational time dilation, gravitational time slowdown. And so the GPS clocks, they're actually out of space, gravity's a bit weaker, so time goes a little bit more quickly for them, and it's about five times as much as the slowdown effect you get to time dilation. But the details of that are kind of messy. So I actually just mentioned that, just really say, hey, you've got to take general relativity into account. But even though it's a larger factor, I don't really spend much time on it because it does not discount the fact that the US military engineers, when they were building the GPS system, they had to do the special relativistic time dilation calculations in designing it. And so sometimes I tell the students that, you know, these are, well, the sorts of calculations, admittedly grossly simplified, but these are the sorts of calculations that they were doing that, again, the engineers had to do when they were building and designing the GPS. So that's the global positioning system. And that's generally where I ended up. It took me a while to sort of introduce that, and I talked generally about Perimeter Institute beforehand. But if I had more time, I talked a little bit about PET scans, or positron emission tomography scans, which are basically brain scans, in some sense, like brain x-rays, and give you some kind of picture of your brain activity and whether different parts of you, left hemisphere, right hemisphere, frontal lobes, or whatever, are more active in thinking harder, there's more brain activity there. And they're used for brain research, just for example, studying mental illnesses to find that people with anxiety disorders or schizophrenia actually have different sort of patterns or signatures on average in their brain, which I think is fascinating. And also detecting things like cancer detecting if you have a tumor. So they're incredibly practical. They're found in hundreds of hospitals around the world. And they're really cool because they actually involve special relativity and quantum physics. And they involve one of my favorite things, which is antimatter. And so the way they work, and they also involve E equals MC squared, which, you know, everyone knows E equals MC squared. And the rough explanation of how they work is when you have these scans, you actually get some liquid with some amount, trace amount of a radioactive isotope in it. So it varies. There could be one of many, but it could be just carbon-15, for example. Just inherently unstable radioactive isotope, basically gets injected into your body, runs throughout your body, and eventually, after some time, it just diffuses into your brain. And then carbon-15, for example, actually radioactively decays via its beta decay, so it's positron decay. So the radioactive, or the nuclear reaction involved, the radioactive decay actually emits not electrons, normal beta decay, but positrons, which is the antimatter twin of the electrons. So they have same mass as the electron, but they actually have so they have the opposite charge, so the positive charge, same magnitude of charge as the electron. And so so you have all these basically positrons running around inside your brain for a little while, but also there are lots of obviously electrons running inside your brain. And so what happens is antimatter positrons, which actually are part of, come from quantum physics, meet up after a tiny split second. They don't move very, very far at all. Very quickly meet up with some electrons in your brain with some matter. And then I ask students, what happens? Does anyone know what happens when matter and antimatter actually meet and collide? And I find probably about 60% of classes, there's one or two students that goes, well, they explode or they annihilate or, the end of the world happens or something like that. And so generally, they have the sort of some idea. Well, at least a few students do. And I say, yeah, so what happens? They actually annihilate each other. And you actually have the electron and the positron colliding. Basically, the matter gets disintegrated. And matter actually gets transformed, as Annie was talking about on Friday night. You can think of E equals mc squared as a transformation equation. And this is one very real example of the transformation of the mass. The electron and the positron gets transformed into pure energy in the form of two photons, two bundles of pure energy. And they tend to go apart actually in opposite directions outside of your brain and all surrounding you when you're in the positive, the PET scan, just this collection of photodetectors, light detectors. And they actually detect where the photons come from. One comes from here, another comes from there. Then they actually basically trace back a line to find out the source, where they're emitted from. And that might be this part of your brain, that part of your brain, or another part of your brain. You repeat that process statistically thousands of times, and then you build up a picture of which parts of your brain are more active, which are less active, and you get those scans there. But then the question arises, quantitatively, how much energy is in the photons that came from the electron and the positron? And I say, look, the equation that happens is that describes just how much energy you need is E equals mc squared. You know about it. It's a transformation equation. And just as I can have 100 Canadian dollars, I can go to the bank, and they have some formula or some calculation they can actually do, and they can transform that or convert that, if you like, to whatever American dollars that gets converted to. You can think of this as being a transformation equation of how much energy gets converted to how much mass or vice versa. And the conversion factor is the C squared, which in SI units is incredibly large, 9 by 10 to the power 16. Then I say, okay, the mass of the electron, you know what that is, 9.11 by 10 to the minus 31 kilograms. The mass of the positron, it's actually the same. So if every time a positron and electron collide, how much energy do you get produced? So again, kids get out calculators and try that. And then after a little while and people getting factors of two wrong because they just do that for one, not twice, that amount, people come to this answer, 1 by 6 by 10 to the minus 13 joules, which is tiny. It's an incredibly tiny number. Because think of each of the lights up in the ceiling, they're probably emitting something like, my guess would be they're maybe 60 or 80 watt bulbs. So they're actually emitting 60 joules every second. So it's a teeny, teeny, tiny fraction. Amount of energy. So that's where I end the presentation. And so we didn't, so one thing I was very, we didn't do any particularly rigorous or physics education research analysis of how much students learn. And I think that's one thing in the future I'd like to do, really to get a better handle on how useful was it? How much did they take away? How much did they learn? I gave them sort of informal feedback sheets and they went through them and I asked the teachers how they thought, much they learned. And you can see their faces, whether they're falling asleep or, they're wide-eyed, so forth. But generally, my impression, certainly the student and teacher feedback was quite positive. And that it seemed to help make relativity seem more real and tangible and not something so practical and far out. And so for a large fraction of students, I think this helps. So every student is different. For a large fraction, this helps provide more motivation to learn physics. So, this is something useful. This is something that, it's worth learning. So it seemed good there. And also one thing, in some ways, I was also trying to talk to the teachers. So it wasn't just for the students. I was also trying to get across to the teachers that there's some really cool calculations that you can do in modern physics, and this is one example. And the mathematics is accessible. You don't need horrible differential integral calculus or anything to do them. And you can actually do reasonable math. Your students can do it. You as a teacher could do it and feel confident enough and understand it to do that. And I think I find it just a very, very cool story that we get from Einstein, 100 years ago, the guy, the image poking the tongue out, the crazy hair, to the picture of basically, to something like this commercial bulldozer. And again, it's just one of many examples how sort of seemingly impractical physics feeds into modern useful practical technologies. So thank you very much.